It is Thursday, July 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, British police are investigating how two more people were poisoned by a nerve agent.
They may have inadvertently, may have accidentally come across a source of this Novichok agent that perhaps wasn't disposed of properly.
Authorities in Thailand race to get young football players out of a flooded cave, and the classic film 2001, A Space Odyssey, reaches the half-century mark. It's all ahead. Britain's Interior Minister says the nerve agent that sickened a man and a woman is the same type used in an attack earlier this year on former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter. The couple was found unconscious Saturday in Amesbury, 13 kilometers from Salisbury, where Sergei and Yulia Skripal were found in March. The unexpected poisoning of the couple, with no known link to Russia, has raised public concerns in the Salisbury area. British Home Secretary Sajid Javid spoke Thursday to members of Parliament.
The use of chemical weapons anywhere is barbaric and inhumane. The decision taken by the Russian government to deploy these in Salisbury on March the 4th was reckless and callous. There is no plausible alternative explanation to the events in March other than the Russian state was responsible.
Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London tells me about what is known about this latest poisoning.
Well, the couple were found on Saturday. They were partners, Charlie Rowley and Dawn Sturgis, in their mid-40s. Both were taken to hospital with symptoms of struggling to breathe, of struggling to stand up, of spasms, of foaming at the mouth. Initially, authorities thought that maybe they had taken an overdose of a drug like heroin or something like that. But it soon was concluded that, in fact, they had been poisoned by this nerve agent, Novichok, which was developed by the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s and was, of course, the same agent used to poison the former double agent spy, Sergei Skripal, in Salisbury earlier this year, Salisbury being just 10 miles from Amesbury, where this couple were found on Saturday. Police have now established that the couple did actually spend most of the previous day, last Friday, in the city of Salisbury. They were shopping and eating out in that city. And so their lead line of inquiry at the moment is that they may have inadvertently, may have accidentally come across a source of this Novichok agent that perhaps wasn't disposed of properly, and they have been inadvertently poisoned by them. They haven't been able to establish any link between Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, who were poisoned earlier this year, and the couple who are in hospital as we speak.
Well, certainly in Salisbury, people there must be very concerned about this, and I would think authorities are taking precautions so no one else couldn't get sick.
They are, and the government has said that the risk to the public is low, although they said they can't say that it's absolutely zero, and they are urging residents of the city who have been around any of the zones that were identified as potentially hazardous to wash their clothing, to wash their hands, and to take every precaution possible. A multi-million dollar cleanup operation was conducted after the poisoning of Sergei and Yulia Skripal in March. But it appears at the moment, if the police's line of inquiry is correct, that that cleanup operation may not have fully cleared everything from the site. And of course, as you say, that does present a very scary scenario for the hundreds of thousands of people who live in that part of England. And so the cleanup operation is once more underway. We see officers and chemical weapons experts in hazard suits once again combing the streets of Salisbury. And of course, this presents a double problem for the government here in Britain. On the one level, they have to deal with this chemical hazard of Novichok potentially on the streets. On the other, there's a whole new diplomatic crisis with Russia to deal with, and it is Russia that the government is accusing very directly of being responsible for the poisoning of two more British citizens in this case, and they are calling on Moscow to say exactly what has happened and exactly what role they have played in this.
Has there been any reaction from Russia to this so far?
There has very fast reaction. They have denied any involvement, and they have suggested, the state media have suggested various conspiracy theories that this was staged by the British government to try to undermine the success of the World Cup tournament in Russia. They have accused Britain of persecuting Russia and trying to undermine its position in the world stage. And so those relations between London and Moscow have taken another step for the worse. All this coming, of course, before some very big meetings that are taking place in the coming days. We have a NATO summit next week. And then, of course, there is a scheduled meeting between the U.S. President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin on the 16th of July in Helsinki. And just previous to that visit to Helsinki, Donald Trump is due to be in London to meet Prime Minister Theresa May. And this, of course, will be top of her agenda at that moment. So some very difficult, very tricky diplomatic paths ahead for Britain, for Russia, for the United States, for NATO, and for the West at large. And this latest incident seems like it will just play into the very difficult relations that are occurring at the moment between the West and Russia.
Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is headed to North Korea for nuclear talks. A protester arrested at the Statue of Liberty on Independence Day will make a court appearance. Pakistan rejects a U.S. call to single-handedly push the Afghan Taliban into peace talks, and Syria and Russia resume attacks on rebels. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the Georgia Institute of Technology have found that two Earth-like exoplanets maintain a stable tilt on their axis like the Earth does, suggesting the planets have regular seasons and a steady climate. One of the planets is Kepler-186f, which is the first Earth-sized exoplanet identified that is orbiting its star within its habitable zone. Kepler-186f, which was discovered in 2014, is about 550 light-years from Earth. The second planet, discovered in 2013, is Kepler-62f. This exoplanet, described as a super-Earth-sized planet, orbits its star that is approximately 1,200 light-years away. The Georgia scientists say that an axial tilt plays an important role in a planet's seasons and climate because it affects how sunlight hits the planet's surface. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, peace prospects dim in eastern Ukraine as fighting there escalates. In northern Thailand, with heavy monsoon rains in the forecast, rescuers are racing against time to figure out how to extract 12 boys and their football coach from a flooded cave complex about 4 kilometers from the entrance. They were discovered Monday after disappearing on June 23rd. Rescuers have been pumping water out at about 1 centimeter per hour, but still some areas are flooded with water to the ceiling, making diving the only real immediate option. 13 sets of diving equipment have been made available, and each person has been given basic diving instructions. Alan Warrell is captain of the New South Wales Cave Rescue Squad in Australia. He tells International Edition's Victor Beattie diving out of the cave carries some risk.
Normally it takes years for people to be competent cave divers, but saying that, these kids aren't going to have to sort of dive much for themselves. All they really have to do is, like, be underwater and you know, keep breathing, and the divers will carry them through.
So you're saying it may not be a difficult process?
No, I think it's going to be quite difficult for them to just keep their cool and not panic underwater. I mean, it's pretty scary being in the dark. It's going to be muddy water. They won't be able to see anything. So that will really be the hardest thing for the kids, is just kind of staying calm as they're taken out, really.
It could be a long process. Will they have enough oxygen if it takes several hours to get out?
That'll be the total time, but they'll be in and out of the water a lot. You don't move very fast, and they'll sort of go through a short flooded section, then they'll be in the air and have to probably the amount of water wade through the water and then get ready to go in the water again and then go through another short flooded section, probably climb over boulders and things along the way with a lot of heavy gear. That's why it takes so long.
How risky is this if they, in fact, dive out?
It is a lot of risk, again, with the kids panicking more than anything else. I mean, there's also the risk, of course, just losing the line or something. But the bigger risk, of course, is when it starts raining heavily again, the whole scene's going to change. There's going to be a lot more water and a lot more current, like the current washing people around and washing people, I'm not sure, in. And depends where they are, which way it gets, you know, washed them a bit out and a bit in. So fighting strong currents, just you use up a lot of air and a lot of energy. Yeah, they have to do things fairly quick, I think.
The heavy amount of rain during the monsoon season will also play a big role in the decision to get them out.
Yes, I'm sure it will. I'm sure they're troubling themselves over that right now. The prediction I saw was it's going to rain heavy on Sunday, so they don't have many days to make their decision and start moving. The problem, I think, is that a lot of the cave will flood very badly, like flood up to the roof, so there'll be no safe place in it for a lot of areas. Probably the halfway alternative is they can find a safe place to move to and not actually come all the way out, which takes a lot more time. They may be able to move just to a safer spot.
Ellen, they're discussing three possible options. The one we've talked about is diving out of the cave system, also exiting through another hole if one can be found or drilled, or waiting out the rainy season, which could take many weeks. Which is the best option?
There's no best option. Coming in from another entrance, well, that hasn't been found yet, so there's no guarantee or even really good indication that there is another route in. And drilling would take a long time.
Alan Warald is captain of the New South Wales Cave Rescue Squad in Australia. The other concern for rescuers is the physical and mental health of those trapped after their prolonged ordeal. But they have been given some encouraging advice from another formerly trapped miner, Mario Sepulveda, who was trapped underground for 69 days in a Chilean mine in 2010, told them in a video message cryptically to hang in there. A United Nations report warns that prospects for peace in Ukraine are dimming as fighting in the Russian-backed, rebel-controlled eastern part of the country intensifies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where an update on the situation in Ukraine was presented to the UN Human Rights Council this week.
The United Nations says more than 3,000 civilians have been killed and as many as 9,000 injured since conflict erupted in eastern Ukraine in April 2014. Despite more than 4 years of war and multiple ceasefire agreements, the latest report by the UN Human Rights Office finds fighting in the rebel-held territory is escalating and civilian casualties are growing. The report covers mid-February to mid-May. It documents 81 civilian casualties, a 9% increase from the previous reporting period. The Deputy High Commissioner of Human Rights, Kate Gilmore, says civilians living in the conflict areas of Luhansk and Donetsk face grave security threats and experience daily hardships, including forced evictions and limited access to health, education, and social protection. She says the Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine also has documented human rights violations against 252 people.
These violations and abuses included deprivation of liberty, enforced disappearance, torture and ill treatment, sexual violence, denial of fair trial rights, attacks on fundamental freedoms, and violations of economic and social rights.
No one comes away with clean hands. Gilmore says the monitoring mission finds the government of Ukraine was responsible for 61% of the human rights violations during the reporting period, armed groups for 17%, and the Russian Federation as the occupying power in Crimea for 22%. Following the report, the Ukrainian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Yuri Klimenko, harshly criticized Russia's armed aggression in eastern Ukraine. He said there would be no fighting in his country without Russian financial and technical support of the rebel forces. He condemned Russia's illegal occupation of Crimea and denounced its policy of racial discrimination and cultural erasure of ethnic communities, including restrictions placed on Crimean Tatars. They were among those who boycotted a 2014 referendum on the status of Crimea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. It was 50 years ago, the sci-fi epic 2001, A Space Odyssey, by author Arthur C. Clarke and filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, opened in theaters across America to mixed reviews. The almost three-hour-long film was too cerebral and slow-moving to be appreciated by general audiences in 1968. Today, half a century later, the movie is one of the American Film Institute's top 100 films of all time. VOA's Penelope Pulu explores Space Odyssey's power and its relevance 50 years since its creation.
The music of Johann Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz is in step with Kubrick's crisp, slow-moving images of space, an otherworldly spectacle watched on huge cinerama curved screens in 1968. Many describe the visual effects of the film as hypnotic, enhancing the message of 2001, A Space Odyssey, that humanity's intellectual advancement was aided by alien intelligence. Kubrick steered clear of images of stereotypical aliens. Instead, the alien presence appears suddenly through a looming black monolith, transmitting signals that teach ape-like anthropoids how to use tools for hunting and survival. Millions of years later, in Kubrick's imagined high-tech world of 2001, the aliens make contact again through the monolith. This time, the slick rectangle prods humans towards an exploration voyage to Jupiter.
And they get to Jupiter, and then that's where the transformation takes place.
Douglas Trumbull was the photographic effects supervisor on the 2001 set. During the film's 4-year production, he helped Kubrick come up with new filming techniques showing Dave Bowman, the only surviving astronaut on spacecraft Discovery 1, making contact with aliens through a stargate, and eventually evolving into a non-corporeal entity.
And it was this idea that you could take photography and open the camera shutter for a long period of time, several seconds, and move lights and blink them on and off in patterns and create three-dimensional light streams for the Stargate.
Trumbull compares Kubrick's technical innovation of using rotating weightless sets and filming in 360 degrees to today's all-immersive virtual reality filmmaking.
A lot of people want to have their virtual reality thing. They want to go into another dimension. They want to have some experience that transcends their everyday reality. That's what I think virtual reality promises.
Equally significant to the film's technology is the plot involving the antagonistic relationship between man and artificial intelligence. Hal, the ship's malfunctioning central computer, and Bowman clash over the ship's control.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Bowman wins and makes contact with the aliens. The last scene takes place in a hotel room the aliens recreate from his memory. There, on the bed, Bowman, a very old man, is dying before he gets transformed into a transparent star child. To celebrate the film's 50th anniversary, artist Simon Birch recreated that hotel room scene at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Exhibit curator Martin Collins explains the lasting power of the film.
The movie 2001, did not seek to pose specific answers to its largest questions, right? What would be the fruits of space exploration? What would be the potential meaning of contact with extraterrestrials? You know, what would be the possible transformations that might occur to humanity as it undertakes exploration outside of the planet? So all of these larger questions are kind of implied here in this room. And I think we hope that visitors will, you know, kind of step back a little bit, think about why this room is here, and think about that sort of larger set of questions that Kubrick and Clark posed in 2001.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And some dramatic music from the film 2001, A Space Oddity, brings us a close to our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. recognizes the desperate needs of the persecuted religious and ethnic communities of the Middle East and is sending immediate help. The U.S. will not rest until these oppressed people receive the help they need to thrive again, wrote U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been tasked with providing more effective and direct support to persecuted religious and ethnic minorities, including Christians and Yazidis. To this end, Administrator Green announced that USAID had redirected more than $60 million in humanitarian and stabilization assistance to provide infrastructure support and life-saving aid in northern Iraq. The money, said Administrator Green, has helped rebuild schools, hospitals, power stations and wells, and ease the transition of those returning home. However, in too many instances, the aid has taken too long to arrive. Many of the communities with the greatest need have yet to be reached. To overcome bureaucratic and other obstacles, USAID is now redoubling its efforts to distribute the aid Iraq's persecuted religious communities desperately need. Every delay brings these religious communities one day closer to extinction. In Iraq, nearly 90% of Christians have fled in the past 15 years, emptying entire villages that had stood for more than 1,000 years. The Yazidi population has been similarly decimated. The time to act is now, declared Administrator Green. Christians, Yazidis, and other persecuted religious communities in the Middle East have suffered unspeakable harm for too long. Their plight has touched the hearts of the American people and stirred this nation to step up with compassion and conviction. The ancient faith communities in Iraq and across the Middle East are counting on us, said Administrator Green. We will not let them down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.